So, here we go for Tuesday night's first question. Ajahn, what did you mean by going inside the anger? You mentioned this in this morning's talk. Did I? Okay, I suppose I did. Going inside the anger means, I think I remember what, going inside everything, whatever you do. So, you get angry, and a lot of times when you get angry, anger takes you outside because it's your fault or his fault or the world's fault. It's something outside of you is where we look at when we get angry. So when we actually go inside, instead of like where the anger's going out to, but where it's actually coming from, then actually we actually see just how, well, first of all, we see how painful anger is. And actually how it hurts you. Somebody once said a long time ago, anger, getting angry at somebody is like trying to pick up a hot coal and throw it at them to hurt them. Whether you hit them or you don't hit them, you certainly burn your own hand whenever you get angry at somebody else. So when you go to the center of anger, you go to where it's coming from. And first of all, you see it hurts. And so it's a waste of time getting angry. And anyway, they don't pay any attention to you anyway when you get angry. So you might as well just give it up. And don't allow what other people do or say to take away your happiness. Why are you letting those stupid people upset you? And why are you getting angry for them anyway? They're just people being people. It's like getting angry at the crows for making their noise. Or angry at the guy today who was having the lawnmower going. So it's just what you have to do. You have grass, you have to have a lawnmower. You have trees, you have to have birds. And some of those birds are crows. You have people in this room, and don't get angry at them if they make a noise, because that's what people do. They make noises. So a lot of time his anger is thinking that people should be something different than they are. The world should just go according to your schedules. And the lawnmower should only come out when you're restless, not when you're about to get into jhanas. But what happens is that it comes out just at the wrong time. So when you go inside the anger, you see it's just a complete waste of time. So you go inside. And actually inside the anger, when you go inside the pain, there's a nice quiet place right in the center of things. There's always quiet places in the center of everything. Even in the center of pain. When you go outside of it, it hurts. When you go right in the center of it, right in the middle of it, as if the pain disappears. I remember one of Ajahn Chah's stories. I can remember him telling me, because in those days, every monk who lived in the jungles would get malaria. It was just a monk's disease. So it was part of the course. But you know, it was very debilitating. And he said that the way he got over his malaria, he got a very bad attack once, and it was just a really heavy fever. And he decided, instead of getting upset about it, just go right inside the fever. I remember describing it was just like this incredible fire, but he was right in the center of it. And in the center he couldn't feel any heat, but he knew it was just burning on the outside. It got hotter and hotter, but he was in the cool place right in the center. And hotter and hotter, and so it got so hot, it just burnt out, and he never had malaria again. That was the last time he had that disease. So he went right in the center of it, and allowed it just to get so hot it just cured itself. That's a nice, interesting little story. So if you go to the center of things, it's amazing what happens in the very middle of things. But not only that, I mentioned a story about the thousand petal lotus just going into the center of anything. You can find jhanas and amazing things in the center of anything. So it doesn't matter what you start with, you can start with anything. And you just keep going in the middle, center, 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 and you find the beautiful meditations. So that's what I was meaning. Even in anger, even in sloth and torpor, anything. That makes sense? Okay, well, it's just hard going into, it's much easier going to the center of nice things than the center of repulsive things. Dear Ajahn, should our sitting posture evolve during a sitting? Yeah, it should evolve. First of all, you sort of, in all sorts of postures, then you get straight. Then you get straighter and more perfect, and then you rise up into the air. That'd be really good, wouldn't it? Hope somebody's got a camera to capture that on film. Yeah, basically it does evolve, and it's being serious, it is a good question, because I remember just, again, in Thailand you had sloth and torpor, you're leaning all over the place, but then, you know, the energy started to come up, you know, just because I was letting it go. And I remember just the first time that happened, just sitting here, pretty slumped. And then my body straightened up. And I was mindful enough to know that I did not do that. I never gave the order. I was very clear, it happened by itself. It's spooky when the body does things without you telling it to. But it did that. And then from that time on I realized the body actually, it will get into its right posture. It's correct posture. So it does look after itself. And as I mentioned, that sometimes it does evolve. If you have a sickness, you start, so I've already seen some people leaning one way, leaning another way. And you probably don't realize that. You probably feel quite comfortable because obviously that's what you need. So the posture does evolve. And when all that healing or whatever is done, it's just the posture gets quite naturally what's really good for you. And you will know what that posture is, or rather the body will know, and it will just do it for you. So it does evolve during the sitting. But the most important part of the posture, remember, your mouth. To make sure the corners are turned upwards. And that evolves as well. That's why sometimes when you're watching people and how they're meditating, you can say when they're getting a really nice meditation because they're sitting with a nice big stupid smile on their face. So yeah, good on you, go on. So it does evolve, yeah. Any comments or questions about that? Okay, next one. When an emotion arises, such as anger, sadness, or fear, we need to let it be. Embrace it with kindness and gentleness. Question mark. Is this right? Yeah, it's the best thing to do, just to be kind to it. And I told many people, that's a rule of thumb. You cannot go wrong in meditation or in life if you follow the second factor of the Eightfold Path, which is letting it be, being kind, being gentle. That's basically right intention is good karma. Because the Buddha said intention is karma. It's the most important part of karma. So if you're doing letting be, being kind, being gentle, that's good karma every time. So if you've got anger, sadness or fear, just be kind to it, be gentle, just let it go. Or let it be. Embrace it with kindness and gentleness. And you find that it just disappears then. Because you're undermining it. These are all anger-eating demons. And so when you embrace it with kindness, it just goes. But with thought, planning, analysis, wanting, we need to exercise restraint, cut them off at the pass, so to speak. Assuming this is correct, why is the difference between our treatment of emotions and thoughts in meditation? Actually, that's the best way of stopping thoughts as well. Just be kind to them, be gentle to them. Let it be. Because then you're developing contentment. And more do you develop contentment, the less need there is for thinking or for planning. Because you all know you don't have to plan all these things. And every time you plan, you should take a record. Every time you plan something, how many times it goes wrong. And it doesn't work out that way. And that plan's a complete waste of time. You'll find that 99% of all your plans, they don't work out. And they're just thrown away. So nearly all of our planning is a waste of time. Every now and again we plan it actually happens the way we expect it to. But that's very, very rare. So most of your planning is just a waste of time. And we know that. That's one of the things the Buddha said. It's yang yang manyati tang tang anyata, it says in Pali. Whatever you think it's going to be, it always turns out to be something else. That's in the Sapurusa Sutta. Whatever you think it's going to be, it will be different. And when I first read that, I thought, wow, that's actually so true. And just means it's a waste of time doing all this planning. Maybe a little bit of planning, but not too much planning. So, when you're content, when you're happy, you don't need to plan. You don't think of planning. You don't have to. A lot of planning, a lot of thinking is just something to do because you're bored out of your skulls. So we've got to think of something. But when you're content and happy, you find the thoughts don't need to be there. So by developing contentment, if you've got thoughts and plans, be content with it. Make peace with it, let it be, embrace it. And then you're actually doing the very best to stop it. But if you try to stop it, you know, with force or with control, you actually create more thoughts. Another way of looking at it, if your mind is like the lake, and the thoughts are the waves on the surface of the lake, You can't stop the waves by patting them down and using your hand to smooth out the surface. You just make more waves. So if you're going to stop the waves on the lake, where do those waves come from? From the wind. So you've got to stop the wind. And the wind is all of your controlling and doing things. Starting things, stopping things, and all of that sort of stuff. So you'll find the more you develop contentment, which is letting be, embracing things, being kind, the more you develop contentment, the more thoughts don't need to come. Therefore they don't come, they just stop. Remember, all thoughts are some business you have to do. When you're content, there's no business to be done. You're content, it's okay, you don't have to do anything. Because you've reached the goal, as it were. You're content. So, why think? So this is how both emotions and thoughts, you stop them in the same way. Just by letting them be. That's the best way. So what do you think about that? Say nothing. I'm content. Georgia, you talked about the conditioned mind yesterday, did I? I don't know what I talked about. I must be getting Alzheimer's disease. I'm getting very, very old. So if you have an important decision to make, e.g., should I live here or move to another place, what is the best way to decide your conditioned mind doesn't influence your decision? Flip of a coin. That's the best way of doing things. Or pass the buck. If you've got a partner, just let them make the decision for you. But actually, this is part of my life. The monks know this. I've told this story to them. When I was a young monk, maybe after 1 year, I made a resolution. And my resolution was I would not choose where I was going to live. If I was sent somewhere, I would go there. But I wouldn't ask to go anywhere. And so I didn't choose where I was going to go. I just was staying in a monastery until someone sent me somewhere else. And I went over there and I stayed there until someone asked me to come back. And that's how I've been doing that for the last 33 years. It was about 25 years ago, somebody sent me to Perth, and they haven't asked me to go anywhere else since. That's why I'm here. Got stuck here. Well, I've actually done that, and I haven't chose where I wanted to stay. So it makes it nice and easy, because every place is the same. You know, you see a tree here, and a tree over in Sydney, a tree in Thailand, or a tree in London. They're the same, really, just a bit of bark and a bit of leaf, that's all it is. The sky is the same. There was a difference between one place and another. So anyway, actually, whenever you go travelling, it's really weird. I try and make the resolution, I'm not really travelling. The scenery is passing by me. The scenery is changing, but I'm sitting still wherever I go. So I never go anywhere. I'm sitting still when I'm in the aircraft. The plane is going, but I'm not going. So it's another little way of looking at things. So you're always where you are. You're not going anywhere. Which is really what life is. Now, that life passes you by, but you're very still. So, if you have an important decision to make, should I live here, move to another place? Don't make it so important, you know, which decision it is, because both decisions are okay. That's why these days, there's no monk, I have to make decisions about monastery or retreat centre or Buddhist society or whatever. But I'm not sort of so afraid of making decisions now, because I know whatever decision you make, there's no such thing as a right decision or a wrong decision. They're just different decisions, that's all. Whichever way you go, you can go left, you can go right. You go left, that's okay. You go right, that's okay. So just different scenery, that's all. And different sort of things happen afterwards. But they're all okay. So I'm not afraid of making decisions, because I know whatever decision I make, you can always make something out of it. So a lot of times, the decision has to be made, okay, we'll do it this way. We don't worry about it so much. I know that before I say, what should I do? Should I do it this way or should I do it that way? For example, like painting the walls of the retreat centre. What colour should we make it? So I asked the builder, and you wouldn't believe how many different colours of paint they have these days. My goodness, it's about to drive you crazy with all these choices. It was much easier in the old times. We just had a couple of colours and that was it. So it's one of the big problems of our modern life. It's so stressful because we've got so much choice. You just go in a supermarket. How many different brands of muesli are there on the shelves? You know, when I was I was a vegetarian when I was a student. It's just to get one brand of muesli. Usually didn't have to sell muesli. You had to make it up yourself. in those days. They're much simpler in those good old days. It reminds me of the story of that many, many years ago of the guy who sort of migrated from sort of Soviet Russia. And in those days, there was hardly anything to eat, you know, just no choice at all. And he went into his first supermarket in the West and he couldn't believe it, just how much choice there was and what was available. You know, you can have like egg powder. You know, you just add water and you get sort of eggs. I've never seen that before, you know. For him, so it had to come from a chicken. And even like potato, you get like mashed potato powder. You know, again, just add water and you get mashed potato. And what really sort of freaked him out was when he saw baby powder. There you go, that's an old joke, but it's a good one. I don't think many of you saw that coming. Very good. So there's a lot of choices we have today. Add water to get a baby. There's so many choices we got today that makes it very difficult. But it's nice. You don't have to worry too much about choices, because whatever choice you make, it's never such thing as a wrong choice or a right choice. It's just a different choice, and it gives you different options to sort of face in the future. So you make it green, you make it yellow. If you put a green paint on the wall, then you have to sort of make sure the furniture matches. You just have a different type of furniture you have to have. You make it yellow, you have to have a different type of curtains, whatever it is. But you can always make do with whatever. So that's why you just don't worry so much. You just make a choice and that's it. That's why sometimes the builder's really happy with me. He said, so what should you have? Oh, that'll do. Is that it? Because most people, they're just really sort of, they're so keen, they've got to get it just right. And anyway, you know, go to the retreat centre. People aren't supposed to be looking at the wall. They're supposed to be looking at their mind, for goodness sake. So it doesn't really matter. So anyway, that's how to make decisions. Just don't worry about decisions, whatever it makes. And if you are worried about decisions, let somebody else make the decision. Pass the buck, and then you can always blame them. Is that okay? Yeah, go on. They sometimes do make choices which sometimes harm others, but most of the choices we make are just pretty innocuous. And then most of the choices which actually worry us, which we keep thinking about and dwelling about, is the innocuous ones. So those ones, innocuous ones, I just flip a coin, it just doesn't matter. So don't lose sleep over those decisions. And that might actually free you to actually just put more attention on the really important decisions which actually do affect other people and affect yourself. I think we worry so much about, you know, and especially when you make a decision, please, 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 don't worry what other people think of you afterwards. You spend all your life trying to please others and trying to, you know, you think, I must make sure I never get criticized for the color which I painted the wall. And sometimes people get so afraid of what other people think. And other people, if they don't like it, that's their problem. I don't care. Yeah, go on. Yeah, the guidelines to check when you're making a decision so you don't get into too much problem is the four agatis, the four things you should check on when you're making a decision. To make sure you're not making a decision out of personal desire, just what's in it for me, not out of ill will, just to get back on the other person, or out of anger, you know, I'm going to teach them a lesson. So not out of anger or ill will, not out of stupidity, so you... That's not a hard one. You know, you just get as much information as you can. So, you know, you're acting out of an informed decision. As much as is available to you. And fourthly, and this is my favourite one, not sort of desire, anger, stupidity. And the last one, not out of fear. And that's the most important one, because so many people make decisions out of fear, or they don't make decisions out of fear. And when you make decisions, you have to be fearless, said the Buddha. So you're not afraid of what people will think of you or what they'll say about you when you make that decision. So make sure no fear, no stupidity, no anger, no sort of personal desires, and then just go and do it. Yeah, just go and do it. And it's stupid not to follow the path. So just go and do it. Because people worry too much about what other people will say, what your parents will say, what your friends will say when you become a nun. So just go and do it and forget about it. Other people just... Next question. Yeah.
But then I once heard a nun, counselor, but beware your gut decision, sometimes that just has hidden agendas.
Sometimes it does. So a lot of time you can follow your instincts, but never do a gut decision when you've got irritable bowel syndrome. So if you're irritable, don't do the gut decision. Yeah, sometimes people do this gut decision. That's... Apparently Mr. Bush was always doing his gut decisions. Incredible, stupid. So, yeah, I mean, take all the information. Check out, you're not acting out of personal desires, ill will, stupidity or fear. And then put it all together and see what comes out. Yeah, in the book I said, decisions in life, sometimes the old simile of getting to a crossroads in life, where you have to make a decision which way you're going to go. But when you come to the crossroads in life, you must always remember that it's okay to sit down for a while and wait for the bus. Because sometimes you don't know what decision to make, so just wait for a little while. And then a decision will come along, like a bus will come. And every bus has a destination on the front, whether it's going to sort of the Perth City, or going to Serpentine, or going to Fremantle. So if that's where you want to go, then get on the bus. If it's going to a destination you don't like, you can wait, there's always another bus coming behind. So what that simply means is you get all the information together, put it all in, and allow it to, as it were, to ferment, to work its way through your subconscious. And then the decision comes up. Wani Nat, who died last year, that, I remember she came on one of the retreats here, and she just came all the way, came late because she was a senior social worker. And she told me she had so many decisions she had to make, but she just couldn't do it in time, so she just forgot about them all, and just came on the retreat. And after 2 or 3 days, all these solutions came up. And she said, wow, they were in the interview, she said, I was just meditating, not thinking about anything. And this solution came up, and it was just a really innovative and obviously a very wonderful solution to the problem. Because she wasn't thinking about them. So all she did was she obviously thought about them, got all the information while she was at work on a Friday before she came here, and they were just sitting in her subconscious. And as she was just calmly meditating and clearing her mind up, then the solutions bubbled up. And that's a wonderful way of making decisions in life. Get all the information in, leave it in the brain, and you go off and do something else, like meditate or whatever. And then 2 or 3 days later, an idea comes up, solution comes up, and it's a great one. You can't think those solutions, you just have to put the information in and let it happen. And the more times you try and force it, the worse the decisions become. So I think that's a great way of making decisions. I do that as well. You've got to make a decision, put all the information in and just leave it alone. A few days later, it's quite obvious what the decision is. So that's also another good way of making decisions. Always put them off. Are there desires which are healthy as long as there are no grasping? Or do we need to reach a state of no desire? Thank you. Yeah, there are desires which are healthy. Like the desire to go to the bathroom before you go to the toilet. That's a very healthy thing to do. I sometimes thought of that. I thought, I was of the idea that enlightened beings have no desires. And then I thought, if night beings have no desires, when they want to go to urinate, they just go to urinate wherever they are. Why go to the toilet? No preferences. But, light beings always go to the loo to go to the toilet. They don't just, go in the carpet. So obviously enlightened beings have desires. That was my proof. But the desires are, for the enlightened beings, the healthy desires is actually for the happiness and well-being of all sentient beings. That's what motivates the enlightened one. Because they've got no personal desires left. It's just for the happiness and well-being of everybody. So remember this, when, according to the story, that the Buddha, after he became enlightened, like this guy Mara, I mentioned him the other day, was always trying to catch him out, to prove that he wasn't enlightened. And so Mara was following him around day after day, trying to catch him out. And then finally, Mara caught the Buddha. After lunch, he had a snooze. He went and laid down to go to sleep. And Mara said, "Ha-ha, caught you. You lazy bum." He didn't actually say that, but that's the sort of thing would have said. Not very nice. Other people are working to feed you and you're taking a rest. You should be meditating or doing something for other people. You call yourself enlightened, that's indulgence. Why are you laying down and sleeping? And the Buddha replied, "I am taking a rest for the benefit and well-being of all sentient beings." And when I sort of heard that, obviously this is coming from a Buddha, it's not sort of like a smart aleck answer. But it's a very deep answer, and that's what the Buddha did. He would take a rest so his body would be fit and healthy to teach other people. Literally, he was living all the 45 years to teach the Dharma for the sake of other beings. And of course, once he got the sanghas, monks and nuns, and all the lay people all organized and strong, there was no purpose for him anymore, so he just left. So for the happiness and well-being of all sentient beings was what motivated him. So those are the best desires of all. And so really sometimes when you're meditating, you're not meditating to get jhanas or meditating to get enlightened. Some of you have already mentioned you're meditating because when you go back to work next Monday, other people will have to put up with you. So, you're meditating for the sake of their happiness and well-being. Which is a very noble thing to do. So, you're meditating not for your own enlightenment or your own wisdom, for the happiness and well-being of all sentient beings. And that's one of the healthiest desires. So whatever you do, sort of on this retreat, do it for the sake of the well-being, the happiness, the welfare of all sentient beings. It's a very noble desire. Make sense? Okay, that's all you're getting. Thank you, everyone, for being so quiet and considerate during this retreat. It's a joy to share the time and space with you. Isn't that nice? Somebody's obviously had a very good meditation. Because you have good meditation, and the whole world is beautiful. Even the way that people fart or pick their nose. It's just so charming and sweet. But when you had a bad meditation, everything people do sort of stinks. So that person obviously had a good meditation today. Dear Ajahn, is there any reason not to wear shoes for walking meditation? No. You can wear shoes if you want. But as I said on the first day, no high heels. I don't think people bring high heels for a meditation retreat. But yeah, you can wear shoes when you go walking. I'm not sure because I've been doing walking meditation inside the little flat where the monks hang out. But sometimes in the grass they've got the little bardies. Are they out now? Yeah. It's worse. Yeah, it's a waste of time doing that with your feet. So it's like walking on broken glass. So you can wear your shoes, that's fine. When you're doing walking meditation. But if you've got shoes, please don't go clip-clop, clip-clop, clip-clop everywhere. Disturb everybody. So do it very, very gently. So it's okay to wear your shoes. But don't wear your shoes in bed. Today in my meditation, a lot of fear has come up. Fear of the physical pain. So instead of going into the pain, I've been trying to go into the fear. Okay, that's nice. to try to find out how I know it's fear when there are no thoughts associated with it. I still don't know the answers, so can you tell me, please? Plus two more questions on the same subject. The more I go into the fear, the weaker the physical pain becomes. So am I just avoiding the pain by focusing on the fear instead? Actually, that question is usually that the fear creates a huge amount of pain. There's all these examples. I remember just seeing this documentary many, many, many years ago. I think I was still a student. The power of suggestion. And it's actually, let's go back to what I was going to talk about first of all, about this hypnosis experiment. Well, they hypnotized this guy, and the hypnotist said, I'm now going to burn you, and took out a nail and said, this nail is red hot. And it wasn't, it was just at room temperature. It was an ordinary, 3-inch nail, ordinary temperature, and he put this on this guy's skin. And of course the guy screamed in pain. Now that was actually understandable, that he was convinced it's going to hurt. But then actually a blister came up. And that was really sort of shook me, that how your mind actually can control not just even the pain, but actually the physical damage, when it was just a room temperature nail. So the mind is incredibly strong, much stronger than you ever think. So when you go into the fear, and the fear creates more pain than anything else. That's why sort of torturers, and they don't just go and torture you straight away. They say, this is going to hurt. This is really going to hurt. You're going to wish you've never been born, or whatever it is they say. It's been a long time since I've been to the movies. So I don't know what they say, but it's always that psychological fear which comes up beforehand, which hurts the most. And even when in the monastery in Thailand, somebody sent us a book. This was in the early 70s. It was like hippie area. And they sent us this little book from the United States of this commune. It's called The Farm, over in the United States somewhere. A group of hippies from San Francisco. They're all druggies. But they, saved the money from doing drugs and bought this commune. But the interesting thing is that in this commune, the whole book was about how they had this amazing birthing process for the ladies in the commune. And they would never call it labor pain. First of all, they took off the word pain. They called it labor energy. That's all. And they basically, when somebody got pregnant, they were counseling them from the very beginning, well, this is not pain, it's not going to hurt, it's just going to be incredible energy of birth flowing through your body. And just when they were giving birth, they were all sitting around actually cheering them whenever they got a contraction, just like on a football terraces. Yay, yeah, go for it! And all these ladies were writing their experiences. And there was a doctor from the local community around them, he just couldn't believe it. They didn't have labor pains, it didn't hurt. It was just incredible energies rolling through their body, and they just completely surfed and went totally 100% with it. And there was no pain. And this is just what I read, story after story after story. Because they were actually conditioned to look at it in a completely different manner, it didn't hurt. But fear, if you come along and somebody comes along and tells you, when you're pregnant, it's really going to hurt, when they come and tell you, oh, when I was pregnant, I was for hours and it just cried, it was the worst thing that ever happened in my whole life. What does that do to you? That really makes it hurt. So that fear is a huge component of pain. So I think whoever asked this question, when you went into that fear, it wasn't you were just sort of substituting sort of your awareness of pain for the awareness of fear. You were actually undermining that pain quite considerably. So well done there. And every time, three times I've tried to go into the pain instead of the fear, my nose has started to bleed and I've had to go lie down on my back for half an hour until the bleeding stops. Just coincidence or not? That's interesting. I don't know about that. I'm not a doctor, but you try to go into the pain instead of the fear. Maybe it's just confronting sort of the symptom rather than the cause. I think obviously the fear, going into the fear really worked. So that seemed to be the main reason why you had the pain. Don't know about the nosebleed. Yeah.
Especially when you meditate, isn't exactly what you
Okay. There we go. So I just have to repeat that for the tape. You say that you found that going into the pain, you know, you find that it's not exactly what you expected it to be. It is more like energy, and it's not where you expected it to be. And the more you go into the pain, the more free you feel of the pain. So yeah, it's another good experience. So you've got a choice there, going into the fear, going into the pain. But just to be my preference would be just to look at the fear first of all, and just lessen the fear, and then go into the pain afterwards. Because I thought, to me anyway, the fear is the worst part of it. And that really complicates things a lot. So my advice would be, but again, I told people, don't just follow my advice. So don't do what you're told. And then people say, we won't do what we're told. So you get the point there. But you know, I would actually probably do the fear first of all, then go into the pain. Ajahn Brahm, is there a chance that you might go into jhanas or sinimittas when you are meditating up the front? Yeah. Up the front, up the back, in the middle. I don't get this question. Is there a chance that you might go into jhanas or do you sinimittas when you are meditating up the front? I don't really get that question, but for me,
yes.
Oh yeah, of course there is a chance you get into jhanas when you're meditating up here. But a lot of times what happens is, if you're like a meditator who knows, you know, you can get into jhanas, you've got to make a resolution. If you're having a really deep meditation, to make a resolution, I must come out at 10 to whatever it is, 10 to 8 to do the chanting. So you actually make a resolution there, so you come out at the right time. If you don't make the resolution, you might be sitting here and the chanting goes on. This is a great story. I forget actually who told it me, but it was from a reliable source. There was somebody as a Vietnamese monk who was teaching a 9-day retreat. It was actually Siddhartha. Okay, very good. I now know the source. I can check out who this monk is. There was a Vietnamese monk who was teaching a 9-day retreat. And he started, you know, like, actually I was in Nolamara on the first night. He started, you know, meditating with everybody first of all. And he meditated, and just, he never gave a talk. He just carried on meditating, and people didn't know what to do, so 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, I imagine they just went to bed. And when they came up early in the morning, he was still there, meditating. For the whole 9 days, he never moved. He didn't give one talk. He didn't eat anything or sleep anything. But people were just so impressed. Because, you know, people talk about these meditators and they actually saw him. They just saw him throughout the whole day. He was absolutely motionless, sitting there. Just in that, obviously, a very, very deep meditation. Now that's impressive. So it can be done when you're sitting up front. But of course, you do that once and people are impressed. But, you know, they do want a bit of instruction, please. Okay, next question. What do you make of the view that first jhana is sufficient to launch insight into nibbana? Yeah, I agree with that. So any old jhana, well, I couldn't swim quite any old jhana. I mean, it's amazing things, these jhanas. It looks like they're sort of trivial things. But any of the jhanas is enough to give you the data and the oomph and the power to get sort of an enlightenment experience. But I thought I might talk about the jhanas and nimittas tomorrow and sort of give you an idea of how they work to get the insights into nirvana. But yeah, just the first jhana will do. So you don't have to get second or third or fourth jhana. And there's still, how many days left? 4 days. So there's still time for you yet. What is access concentration? How do you recognize it in meditation? What are the signs? Okay, the word in Pali is upachara samadhi. And sometimes it's called upachara, sometimes they call it threshold instead of access, because it's threshold as you come into a room and threshold as you come out of a room, sometimes called neighborhood concentration. Actually, is this what they're talking about? Or access concentration sometimes is actually the jhana itself. So I think the jhana is called access concentration. Sometimes that's the way it's described by many teachers. But the threshold, as you come in, as you come out. And in meditation, when you're actually in the jhanas, it's very true, I'll mention this tomorrow, that you cannot get insight when you're in the jhana. It's just too still. You can't move. It's very nice. But the point is, that's where you gather the data. When you come out of jhanas, it's a threshold as you go in, a threshold as you come out, and a threshold as you come out, that's a place where many people get enlightenment experiences. Because the threshold as you come out, you stay much longer on that threshold. It's more certain, more sure, and you're more powerful. So it's usually when people get out of the jhanas, that's when they get enlightenment experiences. Not as they go in. So the access concentration, sometimes that means actually in the jhanas themselves. But the neighborhood concentration or threshold concentration, that's just before and just afterwards. And that is when you've got a stable limiter as you go in. Is giving dana to monks and nuns a very important teaching of the Buddha? Oh yes, I have to say that. Otherwise I'll be stuffed. How is it going to help one with one's meditation and attaining nirvana? Thank you. Yeah, because the Buddha actually said, and we actually chanted it, it's a great field of merit. In other words, the reason is because like the monks and nuns, traditionally and even now, you know, they're almost like the holders of the Dhamma, the teachers, the transmitters of the Dhamma. And so just by looking after the transmitters of the Dhamma, you're actually helping just to keep the Dhamma alive. Not just again teaching, but actually living it, living a renunciant lifestyle, living a simple lifestyle. So the Buddha actually said it's a great field of merit. It's the ultimate field of merit. Not to actually to give to a monk or to a nun, but give the Sangha, the whole community. That's actually enormous merit to do that. So that's what the Buddha said. And sometimes people say, well, isn't it more merit? Look at all the monks and nuns, they're all fat. Shouldn't we actually give to sort of like the poor people instead, to orphanages, to hospitals? But sometimes I look and say, well, even hospitals, how much do they really help? And that's actually quite challenging. It's important to have hospitals. But people go in there and they get sort of healed, which is wonderful. But there's something inside them which never does get healed. And when actually you go to like a meditation retreat, a healing happens on a far deeper level, on the level of the mind, a real permanent healing. Because the body just gets sick, that's its nature. So really all the hospitals do is just patch your body up and you'll get sick again afterwards. Eventually it will die. It can't do very much, it just keeps you going and gets rid of some of the physical pain. But when you actually learn Buddhism, you get rid of the mental pain. And that's huge, just what you can do. I remember going to India, the second time I went on pilgrimage, you know, with book, and went over to the first time, went over to Benares and went down the Ganges. Don't know why we did that, because nothing to do with Buddhism, but it was sort of thing you should do if you go to Benares. And on the way back from the boat, walking to where the bus was to take you back to the hotel, you know, you pass through the poor quarter, and all these lepers came out, you know, real lepers. You know, with bandages and oozing pus and blood and stuff. And they all came out asking, rupee, rupee, rupee. You know, wanting some donations from me. And now, being stupid, I said, I'm a monk, I don't have money. And how can they understand English? So I was really stupid. They didn't understand what I was saying. So, you know, they were asking for money. So all I did was actually just put my arm around one of them and just smiled at him. And he gave me this beautiful smile back, which I'll never forget. It was a wonderful smile of happiness and contentment. And from where it was coming from really blew me away. There was a man living on the street with leprosy, shunned by many people, with open sores. And I've never seen such a smile as that with people who have full medical health cover, who have money in the bank, living in a nice house with a full belly in Perth. And that really started worrying. What is this happiness anyway? I think, why is it that I don't think the suicide rate in Benares is very high, but the suicide rate in Perth is much, much higher. The mental suffering makes you commit suicide. The physical suffering is far less. The problem is with suicide, with mental suffering, you can't see that. You can see the weeping sores of a leper. You can see the broken leg. But you can't see the pain inside a human being's mind as they walk to jump off the bridge or to hang themselves. The mental suffering is invisible. But it's places like this which we heal that mental suffering. You come in, you go out afterwards healed. People can't hardly notice it. They can't see the signs of healing. They only know that afterwards, in the change of your attitude, the change of your lifestyle. So that's why sometimes donating to a retreat center or to a nun's monastery or a monk's monastery, it has a huge effect. But it's an effect which sometimes you can't see. That's why it is a field of merit. Because it solves the suffering which is deep rooted in human beings, which no one else is really looking after. Yeah. That's right, yes. It's true that sometimes people's mental suffering does come out in their physical appearance. Sometimes, you know, they start taking drugs and start taking alcohol and abusing their body. You can see that very, very clearly. And sometimes that sort of the body has been worn down by their mental sickness, and it can come out and people can see it. But for many times it's a very acute mental suffering. It hasn't been there long. But it's acute enough to want them to sort of kill themselves, and it just hasn't manifested in the body yet. And so you see them dangling on the end of a rope. Then you realize that it's manifested. They killed themselves. And it's obviously being a monk, you know, in Perth, being a leader over here, there's many, many times you go to people's house, too many times, because their child has committed suicide or attempted suicide. And every time the parents are just dumbfounded. They never saw any signs at all. It was not manifest. There's one case which comes to mind in Rolling Stone. The parents woke up in the morning and found, I think, their 10-year-old son was on the veranda at the end of a rope, dangling. You can imagine how that felt. They were Buddhists, thank goodness, and so they were a bit more understanding about karma. But their teacher at the primary school was a Buddhist from the Armadale group. And she said, no signs at all. Just a perfectly well-adjusted kid, had his friends. And to this day, they don't know why he did that. But obviously, there was huge mental suffering there, which was building up, which no one, even very, very mindful people, could see. That's why it's so frightening. But places like this, you can actually heal that pain, and to let go of fear, to actually to embrace the pain, embrace the disappointments of life. You see, you know, two bad bricks in the wall is no reason to destroy the wall. So these sorts of things which we teach here are actually very, very powerful. You know, the teachings that I've given, people have come up to me many times and said, you have saved my life. And they meant it. So by, you know, supporting like monasteries, retreat centers, that you are helping sort of, you know, monks like myself, sisters and the other monks, actually save people's lives. Thing is, you can't actually see it happening, but it does happen. And getting people enlightened. That's why the Buddha said it's a great field of merit. because you're actually supporting a system which ends suffering big time. And how's it going to help one with some meditation and obtaining nirvana? Is it because when actually you do something meritorious, you've got like a store of cold karma. It's actually a good question because I haven't mentioned this yet. If ever you get dull, you've got no energy, you know, the days are going by and you think, here we go, another day at this retreat centre. It's going to be the same old boring trying to get my mind to be still. And you get a bit sort of dull and frustrated. Remember some karma you've done, good karma you've done. And when you remember some great act of generosity which you have done, dwell on it, really get into it, until you start crying. And when you still start crying, you get so much energy from an act of good karma, that then you start meditating and it's easy, you've got a huge amount of energy. I told the monks that sometimes that's what I do, because I sometimes go travelling, working hard, teaching all day, and sometimes at night time just had no opportunity for yourself until you got, since you got up at 5 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the morning, and you want to meditate. And what I do, I just remember, what have I done today? Who have I taught? Who have I served? And as soon as I start remembering what I have done, I get this incredible energy coming up. I've actually served people, I've actually helped people. And then my mind just loses all of its sloth and torpor and any tiredness, and it's very easy to meditate from there on in. So if you have made some good karma, exploit it. Remember. And when you remember some really beautiful thing you've done, some real selfless act which you have done, then that just energizes your meditation. Whatever that selfless act you've done, the best good karma you've done, maybe not even with a monk or a nun, just with someone who really needed your help, and you just, it hurt you to give it, right? I remember some of the great acts of kindness and generosity I did when I was a student. I remember this Tibetan nun came to Cambridge. I was a devout member of our Buddhist society in Cambridge University. And this nun came along and started talking about the orphanage she was running up in Kalimpong, just in the northeast of India. And I was so inspired. The following day, I got all the details from her, and the following day I went to my bank and got £10 out to, as a donation to send to this nun. Now, £10 may not sound very much, but at that time that was 2 weeks' food money for me. I never starved, but I actually went hungry. That hurt me physically to give that £10. But because it hurt me, I feel so good. Every time I remember that, you get emotional. That was one of my first really good acts of generosity. You did it and you couldn't afford it, but you did it anyway. And that just made me, I got so much happiness and joy out of that. I get it out of that today as well. So those acts of good karma, when you really realize you're helping, you're doing something, you know, with your resources. Make use of that. And then it gives you the energy and the joy, and you use that to get into deep meditation, and that deep meditation you can use to get into enlightenment. It's just like a power source. So good karma is a huge source of power. And each one of you made heaps and heaps of good karma in your life. You've got this huge account of good karma, but you don't know how to access it. You've forgotten your PIN number. So all you really need to do, the PIN number is just remembering it and indulging in it and feeling good about the fact you've done some good karma. And that actually really energizes and is great for you. Yeah. Aha! You and most other people in this Western world. If you start praising yourself, feel good about yourself, you don't get a big head. You get a big heart. It's very true. I've given this talk in Nollamara. In 2004, I got this John Curtin Medal for community services, leadership, for all the hard work which I do. And as soon as I got this medal, I went up there to receive it. you know, I gave it, he had to give it an acceptance speech. And they said, well, it's very nice of you to give this to me, but it's just, you know, the job of a monk. Why do you give it for me for? There's other people who do much better work than I do. And that was like the gist of my speech. And then the next year, because, you know, people went to see me get my medal, I thought that I should go and see other people get theirs. Being there in the audience. And the next year, that these two people got this medal, and it was amazing what they did. I was really inspired. I think one of them was Professor Jofi, and he started this Brown's Alternative Therapy Centre in Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital in Perth. He was the head of haematology at Charlie Gairdner's, looking after people with cancer, and he got really pissed off that people would get the best treatment, you know, in sort of chemotherapy and radiation therapy, but then just had to leave, and they were not getting any care, any kindness, any TLC. So he decided, he used his influence, to actually chucked a few people out of these rooms in Charlie Gairdner's, and he used that as an alternative therapy centre, and he got sponsorship from Brown's Dairy in Western Australia. And they can go there, anyone having radiation therapy or chemotherapy can go afterwards or beforehand and get a foot massage, Reiki, homeopathy, anything weird, there you'll find it. And his colleagues thought he'd gone sort of soft in the head by doing all this, you know, weird stuff instead of like hard medicine. But he stood his ground, and he's doing continuing research on the effects of, you know, what happens in this alternative therapy centre. It's huge effects. I'm not saying that homeopathy or foot massage or Reiki works, but the very fact that someone's caring for you and being kind to you and giving time to you, I know that works. And so that when I heard what he'd done and the sacrifice, he's put himself on the line to get that up and running, wow, what a great guy that was. And when he received his medal, he said, I don't know why you're giving it to me. There are many other people who've done much better work. And then I realized my mistake, because I saw me the year before. Why is it that people always, you know, people say how good you are. I say, no, that's not me. It'd be great if someone received that medal and they went up there and said, yes, I deserve it. People would be dumbfounded. You're not supposed to do that. But the truth of the matter is, yeah, of course they deserve it. The guys who select don't make mistakes. They do deserve it. But it's just not done. And that's a very terrible psychological fault of our Western society. We don't acknowledge our own goodness. Which is why sometimes we miss out on being happy. And celebrating with other people. I got an award. What a wonderful thing that is. Everyone else was celebrating. I was the only miserable person. No, we're not really miserable. But I just was not making use of my good karma. So next time you do that, celebrate yourself. And you don't get big head, you get big heart. Yeah. Yeah, true. It's actually true, because that's why lots of people go and feed the monks and feed the nuns. There's more food than we can ever eat. But people, that doesn't stop people from going. The reason they do that, because they really enjoy it. And they do get a lot of happiness out of that. And just like I've already mentioned to you that I've met with someone in this retreat, in the morning, they usually have some breakfast. This is in the monastery, usually a bit of muesli and some milk, and they bring a tray of the dry muesli and some milk, and the cats come up, and they want some milk. So I give them cats some milk, and I get more fun out of giving that cat some milk than if I put it in my own muesli. Generosity, dana, is a great source of happiness. So it's wonderful giving things to people. You get so much joy out of that. Dear AB, people are just so lazy these days, they can't even spell Brahm. Can you talk about goal setting, sustaining goal, the goal not to do? Is this useful or a waste of time? Is this a taxi driver simile? How does this fit in with a lotus simile? The taxi driver simile, if you don't know that, is like after this retreat finishes, you may have to go back to Singapore. So you order the taxi at the gate here. And so you get in the taxi, you load up, and you tell the taxi driver, now look, I've got to go to Perth Airport. Now, remember, I've just been on a retreat, so please don't sound your horn, because that's just, I'm very sensitive right now. Don't go too fast, you know, don't go too slow, middle way. I'm a Buddhist. If anybody wants to come in, please let them in, and don't cut people off, and don't drive too fast. And when you get to a red light, doesn't matter, stop on the red light, don't jump the lights, okay? And if you go on like that, that taxi driver will throw you out before you get to the corner of the road. Because the taxi driver knows how to drive his car, and it's his job. All you need to do is to say, take me to Perth Airport. You may say domestic or international, that's all you need to answer. But what happens, we give too many instructions. And that taxi driver similarly, sometimes what happens, you know, with our meditation. Come on, watch the breath. Don't watch it this way, watch it that way. And Ajahn Brahm said, don't control, but you've got to actually watch the breath and not wander off. And if you get into sort of restlessness, just allow yourself to be restless, to be kind to it. And remember, if it's doth and torpor. So no wonder your mind throws you out before you even get 1 minute. And just goes off and does something else. So keep it simple. So, you know, your mind is like a taxi driver. Just give it the instructions. Just watch the breath. And then let it go. And give the mind time to be able to fulfill those instructions. That's, you know, a little bit of control. It's only a slight bit of control. That's okay. But what most of us do is we're always giving instructions almost every few seconds. And that really confuses your mind. If you could have a tape recorder somehow taping the instructions which you were given and play them back to somebody, we'd all laugh, because it's absolutely ridiculous and stupid what you tell yourself. That's a taxi driver, similarly. So setting goals, but sometimes that goals, you know, because we're such high achievers, we don't even actually have ordinary goals. Can we just be peaceful for 1 minute? We always say, I want nimitta, I want jhana. So our goals are way too high to start off with. So if you're going to set a goal which is reasonable. I'm going to be still. Or, I'm going to make peace. If you set the right goals, goals which you can achieve, and which are very, very positive, then it's very easy to find success. It's like when I started off as a monk, my goal, because I was very compassionate, my goal was to save all sentient beings. I didn't realize that was asking a bit too much. Then I actually contracted my goal, just to save one sentient being. May I just help one human being in my whole life as a monk? That was my goal. And when I actually did help one human being, and someone actually did come up to say, yes, Ajahn Brahm, you did save my life, I was completely fulfilled. So everything else in my life now is gravy, it's extra. So I've already fulfilled my goal of monastic life. I've helped somebody. And then, of course, you say, okay, I'm going to help number two now. And then, once you've got number two, only then do you think of number three. So you actually set reachable goals, and not sort of huge goals which sound very nice, but really, really sort of too much. The Ajahn is a method of relaxing, letting go, and being mindful and caring in the present moment, able to get us into jhanas in everyday life. Or is it only appropriate in the special conditions of a retreat? Well, yes. You need actually to keep sustaining this letting go business to be able to get into jhanas, because if you try that in your everyday life, you get the sack from work. So remember, just, you know, there's what you do in retreat time, there's what you do sort of when you're meditating at home or in the temple somewhere. But, you know, you don't try and do that. So, good example of that, when I was in Vietnam, in Hanoi, sort of last May for the United Nations Waste Sack, they had some of Thich Nhat Hanh's disciples there. And being a conference and a bit of a ceremony, they had many workshops, and the leader of the workshops, after the workshops were finished, they all came on a panel and they had to sort of report back to everybody what they decided on, like the problem of like women in Buddhism or Buddhism and climate change or whatever the subject was. And so then it was a turn for the leader of this one workshop to actually to report back. So it happened to be a disciple of Thich Nhat Hanh, an American woman. So the MC said, will you please go to the microphone and report on the findings in your workshop? She very mindfully stood up and slowly walked, mindful of every step as she went to the microphone. And by the time she got to the microphone, almost all her time was up. And the poor MC and all of us said, look, it's all right to do that slow walking when you're on retreat, but look, there's only 8 minutes for each presenter, and you haven't even got to the microphone yet, and 4 minutes you've got. So, you know, it was that type of meditation is great, but, you know, you don't do that when you're crossing the road and the red light is flashing. So that is actually why there's times to do this retreat stuff and there's times not to. So it does get you into jhana during this retreat, but don't try that when you're at work, and don't try that when you are, well, sometimes it's okay if you've got a couple of hours at home and you're meditating, it's very good. But remember, horses for courses, and be very mindful and very wise about your surroundings and what's expected of you. Dear Ajahn Brahm, well, you're always jolly, even as a little kid. I asked my mum about that, I don't know. Have you become like a million times jollier through your practice? In any case, thank you for inspiring, for helping to jolly us along. Now a good example of this, that you know the president of the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, Angie, she came to stay at our monastery a few years ago. And, you know, she got a bit bored, so she was looking through the library, and she got like an old talk of mine, which I think I gave, I think maybe even Magnolia Street, before we moved to Nolamara, an old, one of those cassette tapes. And she played that. It was about 20 years old, or 25 years old. And she played that, and after she came up to me, she said, Ajahn Brahm, that was the worst talk I've ever heard in my life. It was true. I said, yeah, it was. You see, I've actually changed. You actually do learn on the job. You're not born as a great teacher. You just learn it. And I love telling that to the monks, you know, because the monks, they start off, you know, you've seen some of the monks giving their first retreat, like Chittapala, you know, some time ago. Some of the monks, you know, they do a pretty good job when they first start, but, you know, they actually get better as they go along. And so each one of you who've seen these monks over all these years, you know, gone to their ordination when they're little novices and monks, you see them actually grow. It's very inspiring. And see the nuns, you know, see Sister Sari and Sister Hasapanya give their first talk next Friday. Then they're going to run away now. Because it's very inspiring actually to see the Sangha actually grow. So it is true, you do get jolly, you do get sort of more peaceful, you do get more at ease. And that is what's most inspiring of all. So this path actually works. It actually takes, you know, the raw material, and they go in a monk factory and nun factory, and we sort of churn them around, and when they come off the conveyor belt at the end, you know, you've got nice teachers and really good sort of examples. And many of you have been here long enough, you've seen that happen. And that's what's really most inspiring. To see that actually the train and the path actually works. That's happened to you as well. The many of you, I don't know how long you've been coming on these retreats, when you first came, you were absolutely hopeless. It was a complete waste of time. And year after year, you get better and it improves, and you're great meditators now. It's very inspiring for me to see that. So it's not that you're born jolly, you just grow into it. If anyone is interested in catching a flight, it actually is real Buddha air in Nepal, fittingly enough where the Buddha was born. Yeah, but do they serve jhana and nimittas on the flight? Dear Ajahn, is enlightenment reached from the fourth formless jhana, or is attainment of the fourth material jhana sufficient? Also, is enlightenment reached from jhana, or is it better said that enlightenment has jhana as a precondition? Yeah, well, I think I already mentioned that. Jhana is a precondition. They say without sama samadhi, you can't develop perfection of wisdom. So you do need the jhana, so one jhana at least. You don't have to get the immaterial jhanas, not even the fourth jhana. One jhana is enough. I'm still a bit confused about right effort. You say it's all just doing nothing, effort to stop, but the wording of cultivating good things one doesn't have yet. and the definition of right effort makes it sound more active than just letting go. In your simile about the guard, he had to go out and actively invite the good relatives to come stay in the empty house. He didn't just stop, sit there and do more and more nothing. Please kindly explain further. Not always, as long as there's lots of food and a nice, LCD big TV set in there, then of course your friends will go and have a visit. And they come by themselves. So your job is just to make the house attractive for good friends and unattractive for the thieves. So what that means, you'll have to make your mind attractive for these wholesome states of mind and unattractive for things like anger and greed and frustration. And you know that how to make it attractive for these beautiful states of mind is to relax and be peaceful and be still. And then all these beautiful things come to you. It is a case in meditation that if you go seeking for things, they will run away. But if you just sit there and be very still and peaceful, all these wonderful experiences, they come to you. That's the nature of things. So that's what real right effort is. It's an effort to shut up, sit down, and stop complaining. Is it true that anybody on this retreat can attain jhanas? There are not differences between people due to past life practice. There are differences due to past life practices, but until you can get your previous life memories and know that you can't, assume that you can. So you've been born as a human being. You come to the centre of Buddhism in Australia. I know you have people from Sydney and Melbourne and South Australia here. So you've had a great good karma to come on a 9-day retreat, so you're already doing pretty well. So if you got this far, assume you can go just for the last lap and get the jhana. So always give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Why not? In fact, according to Buddhism, the only people who cannot get jhanas or enlightened is if you've killed your father or killed your mother, or what else, have created a split in the Sangha, or cut the Buddha's foot, injured the Buddha. What else are the other ones? Have you done any of those? Anyone done any of those? Okay, so you can all get jhanas. Yes. Settled. Okay, so that's this evening's questions. We went on a bit longer, so I don't want to go on too long. Because the night is still young, you certainly don't get jhanas by listening to me sort of rabbit on answering questions, but you do by closing your eyes, by meditating, by being still and allowing stillness to develop and get more and more powerful, by remembering all the good karma you've done. Remember that. And that brings you a lot of peace and a lot of happiness. And from that, you can actually jump into the deep meditations. So bring joy to your mind. All of you, if you haven't actually done lots of good karma, you've been on pilgrimage to India, many of you. Gone to those holy sites. Wow, can you remember what it felt at those places? Or you met great monks, gone to great places, great nuns. Visualize them. It gets lots of energy up. And then allow that visualization to disappear. And then you can just watch the breath, and it's just so easy to do. So that's one way of getting into deep meditation, quickly and easily. Okay, so there we go. So those of you who want to meditate flat out, who want to do what I call the Ananda method of enlightenment, and I'll explain that tomorrow if you want to know what the Ananda method of enlightenment is. I might as well say it now, because you know that Ananda, he was the attendant of the Buddha, and he was with the Buddha for 25 years, listened to all the great teachings of the greatest master. And when the Buddha said he was about to pass away, I'm not enlightened yet. 25 years I've had the teacher with me and haven't become enlightened. What am I going to do? I'm stuffed. I've had it. No enlightenment for me now. And so the Buddha passed away. And poor Ananda, he blown his opportunity. He was with the greatest master and he still wasn't enlightened. So it's just really, really miserable. So, a few months later, it was Mahakasapa. He decided, he's this great enlightened monk, decided to get all of the great monks together so they can actually collect all the teachings. Because, some monks remembered one thing, another monk remembered another thing. So they wanted to put them all together and just record all the teachings to actually directly to that, bring it all together. So they decided to bring 500 monks. 499 of them were completely enlightened, were arahats. And the odd one out was Ananda, because he'd heard so much. They decided to invite him in anyway, even though he wasn't enlightened. So it was the following day they were going to have this big meeting. Imagine that was you. Everyone else was enlightened except for you. Imagine this was the last day of the retreat, and I made the announcement. It's an amazing retreat. Everyone has become enlightened except for you. Imagine how you'd feel. That's how Ananda felt. So he said, I can't stand this. So he meditated for bust all night. No sleep, because he had to get enlightened. You know, just his ego would not let him sort of, you know, be unenlightened amongst all these other great 499 monks being the odd one out. So he meditated and meditated and meditated, walked and sat. He didn't sort of even think of sleep. And when the dawn came and the sun rose, he still wasn't enlightened. He really gave it everything he got. He tried his hardest and still he didn't get anywhere. So what did he do? He just gave up. What's the point? No way can I get enlightened. So he went to bed. And they say just as he began to lay down, just before his head hit the pillow, he became enlightened. And just to prove the point, he was actually late going to the meeting. And they locked the door and he came in through the keyhole. To prove the point. That was pretty sort of showing off a little bit, but he needed to actually to tell him everyone that he was enlightened with psychic powers. So, ever since that day, we call that the Ananda method of enlightenment. So when you go to bed, maybe this might be your time. Before your head hits the pillow. And maybe you can try that two or three times a day, that Dharma meditation. So, and of course, you know why he got enlightened. Because he'd let go. He too was trying. And he had immense effort. But it never broke through until he just let go and gave up. And that's a very good lesson how to get into deep meditation, how to get enlightened. So anyway, off you go. Try Ananda method of enlightenment now. And see you in the morning. And if you do get enlightened tonight doing Ananda method, please just, is there a keyhole here? Please show off.